The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
We've got lots of our sunny panellists in here as well to go through our newspapers with us. Joining me, I've got Francis Fitzgerald, former MEP. I got Brian Mahan, political correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail, and Anna-Marie McHugh, assistant managing director of the National Ploughing Association. You're all very welcome.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I noticed on the front page of the Sunday Independent, there's a bit of celebrity news this morning in that our very own Saoirse Ronan it's announced that she has tied the knot in secret, which seems to be the way to do it if you're a celebrity these days. Maybe if you just have a small wedding as a punter, it could be deemed as doing it in secret. But I guess if you're Saoirse Ronan, it is. And it's nice to see, isn't it? And I think people will be generally very happy for her, Anna-Marie.
Yeah, I think so. Look, they're together since 2018, I believe. So, you know, 6 years, it's not a mean feat. So please God, they'll have a happy life together. A bit disappointed she didn't do it in secret somewhere, maybe in West Cork. You know, it's kind of always the girl's prerogative to bring it home. But
yes,
there you go.
It was in a Scottish civil ceremony. She married the actor Jack Andrew Loudon at the Edinburgh Central Registrar's Office. I had to laugh at the article because even if we're writing about celebrity weddings, our love of property as Irish people always comes out. Mm-hmm. And the article says, the County Carlow star and Loudon share a €2.8 million home in Islington, North London, with their terrier, Fran. In 2020, Ronan was reported to have purchased a two-bedroom waterfront cottage in Ballydehob, which almost reads like an estate agent's brochure. Yeah, it reminds me of a friend of mine who has a very lovely, expensive car. And he finds that in our, you know, he takes it abroad racing. And when he's in other countries, people come up and they look at the car and they look at the sleek lines and they ask about the engine. And if he has it on display in Ireland, people come up and immediately look at the tax disc to see how much he's paid. And I guess that's kind of the Irish mentality. But it is nice to see Saoirse Ronan tying the knot. And we wish her all the very best with that. Of course, it is a very big day in Croke Park this weekend. It's the first time since 2010 that we have an All-Ireland final without Dublin, Mayo or Kerry. So it's a novel pairing for the All-Ireland football final, Armagh versus Galway. And Tommy from Off the Ball has the build-up. What has the build-up been like and what can we expect on the field today?
Morning, Dermot.
Morning.
How are you? Yeah, I think it's going to be very exciting. Today, you mentioned the novel pairing. It was a little bit like having no Limerick in an All-Ireland hurling final.
How very dare you.
And no Kilkenny. It was great. Mm. It was fantastic.
Yeah.
You saw the emotion and the celebrations in Clare. It was off the charts. I'm actually living down in Clare these days and got to cover their homecoming. 40,000 people were out in Ennis to welcome them in. Mm. And just when you see how happy people are and how much they enjoy it, it's just nice when it's going to a county that aren't used to winning.
Well, it does incredible things for a county, even to be in the final. It really lifts it. And I do remember being a Limerick man back in 2018 when it all started, when the dream started back again, you know, and the flags outside, you know, every house in the county. Mm-hmm. And it's a really, really special occasion. And it's going to be a close one too, isn't it?
Definitely.
And I guess it's very fitting that both captains, Ciarán Mageaney and Pádraig Joyce, were on the pitch. You know, the last time Sam Maguire was raised for their counties, over 20 years ago, and it'll mean a lot to them. But how important is the bench going to be for Galway, do you think, today?
For both sides, Dermot, it's going to be absolutely huge. And like last weekend, we watched an absolute epic in the hurling when Clare and Cork, and I went to extra time. And I was actually speaking to a great GA man yesterday, Sean Boylan. So the Meath team from 1999 are being honoured today in Croke Park. So I managed to sit with Sean in his garden for supposed to be 20 minutes. I think I was there for 3 hours in the Boylan household. So apologies to all the lads for staying so long. And but just when you're chatting to Sean about all the memories and the stories, and Sean felt it was nearly cruel last week that went to get extra time, that it should have been ended at full time and gone to a replay. Sean Boylan, of course, managed that Meath team against the Dubs back in 1991 that went to 4 replays. And that was incredible back then. And like, it's just the way the calendar has gone a little bit that there's no room for these replays. But today, if it goes to extra time, the one good thing for Armagh people is that it won't go to penalties today, because they have just had cruel luck when it comes to penalties.
The Ulster final was a hard one to take.
Dermot, I think it's 4 penalty shootouts. Mm-hmm. I'm afraid to even count them up, and I think it's 4 in the last 2 years, and it's ridiculous how fine the lines can be sometimes in sport. You saw with the last Cork shot at the weekend, a little tug at a jersey, the ball just goes wide and We could have gone for a replay.
But isn't that the interest? One of the interesting things about today is that you have Galway, you know, 9 wins in a row. They're in the zone, in the flow. But you also have Armagh, who are taking that resilience from those cruel, cruel losses. And that has to be something that, you know, goes up on the wall of the dressing room, as they say, that, you know, not again. We have to have the strength to get through this.
Absolutely. And, you know, that could break a group. What happened to them over the last couple of years, but obviously it strengthened them. And famously, back in 2002, like, Armagh have only ever won one All-Ireland title. It's unbelievable. You know, it's a county that we would associate with the last 25 years have always been in the mix, we'd say. But back in 2002, there's a famous story of Joe Kernan going around. He'd lost a couple of All-Irelands for Armagh. And in the dressing room, he was the manager in 2002 against Kerry. They're only 4 points down at half-time, but he had planned this during the week. He brought his loser's medal and his plaque into Croke Park. And he showed every player the loser's medal at halftime and smashed the plaque off the wall and say, you boys won't be losers when you walk out here today. Now, Kieran McGeaney was in the dressing room that day. McGeaney is an unbelievable character, very charismatic and inspirational. He does a lot of
jiu-jitsu.
And he was going around with his arm in a sling there. He ripped a couple of muscles in his arm earlier this year. So I think it's actually, he hasn't been able to train for the last 10 weeks. So I wonder, has he been able to get out that kind of, I don't know, aggression and frustration that's in him all the time. So I wonder what the halftime speeches will be like today in Croke Park. He's usually quite calm, and the backroom teams on both sides are stacked. Like, Kieran Donaghy is on the Armagh backroom team, and Conlon Gilligan, who would have played with Derry, and Kieran McKeever. And then on the Galway side, Pádraic Joyce has John Dively and John Kincannon and Micheál O'Donnell, who would have been with him in the 90s and the 2000s when they won All-Irelands and would have been on that great Galway team back then. And they also have Keane O'Neill, who has been involved in All-Ireland finals at Tipperary with Mayo, with Kerry as a trainer as well. There's unbelievable, I suppose, dynamism on the sidelines. The benches are both stacked with quality players that are going to come on at some stage and make a difference. And the players in the field, it's just going to be so interesting today. It will be a little bit more tense than the, not a little bit more tense, it'll be as tense and chaotic as the hurling, but just in a different way. Like, they're such different sports, but like, it'll be amazing.
Yeah, some people, I guess, with an uneducated view of Gaelic football might think that there are similarities to jiu-jitsu at times.
Sometimes.
If the match is particularly heated. Yeah. If we're trying to predict what's happening, there's an interesting story in the papers today about a certain lobster that was found off the coast of Galway, but it is what you would call a colour morph. So it's, I guess, the lobster equivalent of an albino. So it's a bright orange colour, more like the colour you would get if you actually cooked it.
Wow.
This was obviously raw and plucked off the seabed and examined by Kevin Flannery, a marine biologist from Dingle.
I know Kevin. He knows the stuff.
Okay. Yeah, well, the thought is that maybe because it's bright orange, that this is a good omen for Armagh today, even though it was found off the coast of Galway.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of trolling going on there. I'd say they planted that there just to get into their head. So I think that could be a thing, Dermot. But look at, like, the colour. Like, we had actually a roadshow on Thursday night in Croke Park. It sold out in June in 6 hours. Loads of Dublin and Kerry fans bought tickets to it. It's a Gaelic football podcast, The Football Pod. And during the week, they all started offloading them, the Galway and Armagh fans. So we got into Croke Park the last day. It was full of Armagh fans and head to toe and Galway fans. And they were actually really rowdy. Like, it was class. They're really up for this today. And I know the M1 is going to be absolutely jammers. The M6, people coming from Galway, is going to be off the charts. And whoever, like, the songs recently, whoever's the DJ, the house DJ in Croke Park the last couple of games has just been nailing it. It's been off the charts. I've never heard N17 sung the way it was sung. I'd say at a Saw Doctors concert you wouldn't get it like it was in Croke Park when they won the last day.
I tell you, the Saw Doctors must be just laughing.
Of course they are.
Because they
beat the Saw Doctors now. I can't see the Freed From Desire beating the Saw Doctors. I think there's something in that for Galway as well.
No,
we all know.
I mean, how many
N17.
How many revivals have that band had? You know, and actually I've had the pleasure in the past of playing in a very, very mediocre punk cover band, and we've supported the Saw Doctors on a couple of occasions.
Cool.
Lovely lads. But I think they're always like, how do we keep getting this constant renaissance where our songs are back in the public psyche? And it's you know, it rightly so. They're great tunes, but obviously, as you say, that'll be sung up and down the M6 and M4 today. And I feel sorry for anyone serving a burger on any of those services, because it's going to be full. And in a way, that's where the atmosphere begins. It's on the coaches, it's in the cars, it's in those...
The trains,
It's on the trains and...
But the atmosphere, I was there last Sunday. I mean, the atmosphere was just electric.
Wasn't unreal.
It was fantastic. Mm. I mean, if today is anything like it, well done to the GAA and all the supporters and all the players. It's totally brilliant.
It was, wasn't
I mean,
it?
Oh, it was utterly,
hairs in the back of the neck.
Utterly engaging. You got to the point where you felt nobody should lose this because it was so, I mean, it's incredibly close.
Yeah, I think.
Marvellous.
Mm. I think it might, something like, if it happens similar this weekend, I think we could be having replays in All-Ireland finals a little bit more. Because I think some people want replays back, but I understand why they're not there. The calendar has been condensed so tightly, we're not going to get into that here. But
6-1, I think the odds of a draw today are.
Well, I think it was 60-1 for there to be a draw in both the hurling and the football after normal time. So I hadn't said it for that reason, but I had felt 2 weeks ago that we were going to get replays. It's easy to sit in the fence when you're on a football podcast as well, because you don't want to get in trouble for your predictions, but it's just these games are going to be so tight, like they're just so well matched that that could easily happen today.
Yeah,
I love the excitement that you have, and I see this a lot with, you know, you get into sport and you do your job because you're passionate about sport. What's it like in the press box when half your brain is a super fan and you just want to watch this, you know, amazing spectacle, but then the other half is like, oh crap, I better write something down, or, you know, what minute was that, did that happen? And, you know, I had a very brief time as a rugby reporter from Thomond Park as a Munster fan, and I found it absolutely torturous trying to do that job and keep both sides of the brain switched on for that. How do you navigate that?
Oh, like Tony Kelly, what he did last week, you know, in the hurling.
Yeah,
I think everyone was just like, what has just happened? You know, it's just off the charts. And I watched it with Tommy Walsh, who's won, I think, 9 All-Irelands. It could be 10, it could be 11 with Kilkenny. He's won an unbelievable amount of All-Ireland titles with Kilkenny. And even Tommy is getting lost in the moment. When you have nothing on the line and you're neutral, it's great, because you can just take it in and keep typing away and get your reports filed or get your pieces ready. But it's amazing just to get caught up in it and lost in it as well.
If you react,
the commentaries are so brilliant.
Yes.
I mean, the level of knowledge you have just listening to you here, it's extraordinary. Mm. And then the commentaries, when you listen to it, whether it's radio or TV, that it's fantastic.
Is it considered uncool to go, hey, yes? Or are you meant to?
I wouldn't do that. No, definitely.
Referee!
But you'd see.
Must be tempted sometimes.
What's brilliant about Croke Park, though, is that, like, where we'll be situated today, it's the seventh tier, so we're given kind of A1 and 2, so we're looking down, you're looking down on the pitch and everything. But to my left today would probably be a Galway local radio station, and behind me will be an Armagh local radio station. Yeah. So you're getting caught up in all the noise.
Yeah,
and
great.
What usually happens is the best thing is the press box is right beside the supporters. So if there's someone sound or knows their stuff beside you, they're the only one to ask to who scored that. Because in the hurling, you miss things all the time. Like, there's no point asking the local lads or whoever, because they're as busy or as frazzled as you are. So
I'm sure you've all heard of the Galway BFM piece.
Oh, unbelievable.
At the after Ollie, last week. And it was just brilliant.
Yeah. Just, well, isn't that just, that's the Irishness of it.
Yeah.
You know, and those things are so important to us now, you know.
And I, final one, the game has obviously been broadcast on RT and on BBC. Like, last week,
BBC doing it. I think it's just fantastic.
Thomas Niblock and his team last week, obviously it was broadcast to everyone in the UK, and you saw the reaction afterwards. I think you're going to get something similar today. It's a slightly different reaction. They mightn't think it's like Quidditch, but what on earth is going on here? You know?
It was reminiscent last week about the that line delivered by Jason Statham in one of his action movies when he attacked a few lads with a hurley, and they're like, what's that? And he goes, it's a hurley. It's a sport that's a cross between hockey and murder. Which I thought hit the nail on the head. Tommy Rooney, thanks so much for joining us. Stay tuned to Off the Ball right across the day. You won't miss a thing. And best of luck to both sides. And best of luck to the fans. Enjoy the day. And lovely to have a nice day as well. Thanks, Tommy. Let's go into the papers, shall we? Because Bishop Eamon Casey and the story around that and the revelations are definitely making headlines, particularly in the Sunday Independent and the Daily Mail. Francis Fitzgerald, former MEP, is with me, of course. What do you make of all of this? I mean, in a way, in a more sinister way, if you compare it to the RTE story, it seems like more of the same. And you wring your hands and you go, are these revelations ever going to end?
Probably not, unfortunately. Mm. Extraordinary. And well done to Anne Sheridan and RTE, because what emerged from that was a whole other side in relation to Bishop Casey and information that really wasn't in the public arena. Maria Cahill has a very good article in the Indo where she talks about, you know, when the revelations about Annie Murphy came out, people felt sort of sorry for Bishop Casey with his celibacy and all, kind of understanding he was sent into exile. Then you have these revelations, and they are new, about, you know, far more, you know, adding to what was already there is 2 years after the first statement from the Galway Diocese where they said they had one allegation, They then, 2 years later, said they had, in fact, five allegations of child sexual abuse on file, as well as other complaints made by adult women who had relationships with Bishop Casey. So it's yet another story of a powerful man abusing his position. It's kind of a Me Too story. And you remember how we spoke about Annie Murphy at the time and how she was interviewed by Gay? You know, she was the villain in the piece, that's for sure. And now you have his niece, Patricia Donovan, who formed a big part of that documentary, talking about what she went through. Of course, there was never a case. He was never found against in court, never went to court. But the church did. It was a great theologian on that program. He said the church took a preventative line in relation to him, told him not to be in ministry from 2007. And yet he continued in that. He continued turning up at the funeral of Patricia Donovan's mother and, you know, still being part of the clergy. And then he was, of course, buried in the cathedral. And now there's a question of, you know, the church looking at that now and saying that the headline is, Taoiseach obviously has made a statement about really putting victim centre stage. And then church considers moving bishop's remains. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, well, she talked about the shock of seeing all of these cardinals with their red hats at the funeral. I was shocked when
I saw
it.
It was only 7 years ago, the funeral. Bishops, hundreds of priests. And I thought it was quite telling in an ironic way, I guess darkly ironic way, that the church's first reaction, you know, when there's a negative story about a cleric is to move him. You know, in this case, he's not alive. But that's the immediate reaction. Let's move the problem, you know.
No. The interview I found very interesting was from Archbishop Dermot Martin, who said he told the Irish Mail on Sunday he never had any idea Bishop Eamon Casey was a child abuser. Interestingly, he didn't go to the funeral because he thought he knew enough about him not to go. But he never knew about that. He said, I heard there were problems about relations with other women. So the church never joined the dots, which is so frequent. They never, you know, nobody at a high level put together all of the allegations that they obviously knew about from various places.
They didn't want to join the dots.
Oh, well, I mean, the denial is still, I mean, ambivalence about child sexual abuse, denial, protecting the institution. Hopefully they've moved somewhat away from it and they have better procedures in place. I know that from when I was Minister for Justice and you had Ian Elliott doing all the safeguarding reports on. But of course, now we're going to have another report on and probably a statutory inquiry into boarding schools. So when you say, will it go away? Mm. Well, we have a lot to learn about boarding schools in Ireland and what happened. This is going to be as big as the Ryan report and the other reports that we've had, I think. So it's a very shocking past when it comes to women, the church, abuse of power. It really is. Very disturbing.
There is a message in to 53106 saying, in relation to Bishop Casey, just look at the way RTE and Gay Byrne interviewed Annie Murphy. I think you touched on that there, that deference at the time where they were constantly turning up on chat shows, you know, alongside a celebrity, that, you know, they were celebrities in themselves. And I guess that's what gave so many of them protection over the years. I thought it was telling in a week and I guess fitting, I suppose, when there was so much talk around Sinead O'Connor and I guess the waxwork debacle, but I guess it put Sinead back into our thoughts and circumstances around her death appear in the papers as well today. But I heard Fiacna O'Brien from the Hottest Flowers talking, you know, quite beautifully about her and their relationship working together and the fact that Sinead in her very early 20s was highlighting things like clerical abuse and trying to get the message out there. And of course, in a very, very different Ireland at the time.
I heard that interview and it was a beautiful interview. Mm. But he talked about her being ahead of her time, talking about child sexual abuse. And I was a social worker in Dublin in the 70s. And I remember dealing with cases then and it was just emerging. Because, you know, people could hardly believe such a thing existed, particularly within families. They just couldn't believe that, you know, a father would abuse a daughter or a brother a sister. And yet we've now discovered it is such a big part. And I suppose what we have to do now is be so victim-centred and really reach out and give the supports to victims and believe victims and make sure issues and cases are investigated very quickly and properly by all organisations. These are cultural issues as well.
Yeah, really important. Stay with us. I've got our panel here this Sunday on News Talk and the Anton Savage Show. It's Dermot Whelan with you. We have Brian Mahan, our political correspondent of the Irish Daily Mail, Francis Fitzgerald, former MEP, and Anna Marie McHugh, Assistant Managing Director of the National Ploughing Association. More from them in just a few minutes. We've got our news panel here with us. Brian Mahan, political correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail. We've got Francis Fitzgerald, former MEP, and Anna Marie McHugh, Assistant Managing Director of the National Ploughing Championships. And Willie O'Dea, a fellow Limerick man as well, is in the Sunday Independent today, giving out about the potential for a winter election. And I wonder, Brian, is this a common thing you've come across with, in your work as a political correspondent? Politicians giving out about the idea of walking around knocking on doors with cold hands and poor winter coats?
Well, I'd say two things. I don't think there's a politician or an advisor in government buildings who you talk to who doesn't seriously think that there won't be an election before the end of this year. Now, Simon Harris has repeatedly said it is his, quote, intention to go to the end of March, and Willie notes that in his piece there. But secondly, this isn't the first time we've heard this rallying cry from Willie O'Dea. I think this might be the second or third time he's written the same column, being like,
"Please
don't do
this." Does he just not like the cold? Or I mean,
that is essentially it. But also, you know, in the dark evenings, do punters like to have politicians calling to their doors in December or January? So December, you're enjoying yourself, you're out with your family and friends. January, you're poor, you're broke, your credit card bill is coming in, and politicians coming in telling you stuff. You're probably like, would you give me a break?
But you're home.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's more chance of somebody being there. And I would argue, do people want politicians calling to their door at any time of the year?
I personally think this argument is a little bit overmade, and I don't think it's as bad as politicians make it out to be. They just don't want to be out in the wet and wind and rain. I do think the better political argument for going earlier is the longer you leave this, if you actually run the whole way out to March, you can have, you know, a kind of the immigrant crisis could raise its head again. Housing might become an issue. You don't know events, dear boy. Mm. Events is basically the actual argument against going to the end of March.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if the government kind of ends up making the argument when the budget is done, saying we've basically got everything we can do done. There's very little left to do. Let's just have the election. It would be a debate or a talking point for the first 36, kind of 72 hours, and then people would get over it and start going hammer and tongs.
Well, it would seem to make sense. If you're going to be giving out a load of sweeties, you know, to the children at the budget, it would make sense to kind of surf that wave a little bit. Anna Marie, I'm conscious that the ploughing, you know, is one of these, is mecca for politicians, you know, because that's where they can really shake hands and press the flesh and do all those things. As Assistant Managing Director of the National Ploughing Association, it would make sense, and you've seen them down there. You'd be surprised if they weren't all there and using that event to make those connections.
Just the timeline, like we're on the 17th to the 19th of September. Mm. So, you know, it's a real timeline. I think they'll be there this year anyway, even if they haven't called it, because it'll be their last chance of an event that size to meet the general public and the Ordinary Joe's Soap. And in fairness, they get sidestepped quite a lot of the ploughing, and they have to answer questions. So you have to be
fit for the day. What's the reaction in general? I guess in the past, maybe I'm imagining it might have been a little bit more deferential. Do they get more of a hard time now, do you think?
They do, but there's still, I think, there's a rural thing about respecting politicians too. I don't think that's gone anywhere. And even I go back as far as the time that Bertie Ahern was really in a tough status and pretty much in hiding that they reckoned. And we had the World Ploughing here the particular year in 2006. And he turned up and he faced the people head on. And I remember Mary Coughlan doing Minister for Agriculture in tough times. And the best thing about rural community, face them and take their questions and answer the questions and move on. But politicians will want that opportunity. And look, we're getting the calls already about who wants to come and what's the process of getting there and all that. So they'll be there in their droves. They're absolutely
I do remember the elections in County Limerick when I was very young, and they would happen in my local national school. And there was a big buzz in the area. I mean, they were almost, you know, like celebrities if you saw them standing with the rosette outside the school gates. And I remember just basically badgering their entire teams for stickers, and whichever party gave us more stickers, they got my vote. You know, that was my vote was easily bought at age 8 or 9.
And now these,
like all voters,
the stickers
yeah.
are
yeah.
an, the stickers are an environmental issue now. If you're, yeah. if you're going around with stickers, is it the thing or not? You
yeah.
know?
Francis, you know, you've knocked on doors over the years, over 30 years, doing what you do so well. What would be your preference if you were
oh, well,
in
you know,
government now?
Or? You could see it in the recent elections. You know, mm. there's a great feel-good factor when the weather is good. Like, it's fantastic to be out canvassing. Mm. It really is. There's just that great atmosphere. And it was like that this time. But, like, the winter is pretty, it's tough going being out on those winter nights. But the truth is, I agree with Brian, once it's cold, you just get on with it because you're mm. just utterly focused. But you're falling a bit around the place in the wet weather and going up steps and slipping and you're trying to get your literature indoors and it's getting mm. wet. And, you know, it's a tougher. I mean, there's a lot of copy on when the election will be. I mean, people are making assumptions, you know, that if the government goes on further after Christmas into the new year, you know, they could find it tougher. You are right, you're up against the deadline. So crisis, you don't have time to resolve them. But, you know, both the Taoiseach, Simon Harris and the Taoiseach, they both said, Micheál Martin, they want to continue. They have done a lot of legislation already. So it's probably a little bit events, dear boy, events, mm-hmm. In terms of the decision. I'd say it's not taken yet. But they are keen to go on, you know, so... It's hard to give up power as well, you know. Obviously, you have to when you know the election has to be held by February. Mm. February, isn't it? Yeah, February, March.
End of March.
Yes.
With social media now, Brian, how important is actually knocking on the doors now? Does it hold the same weight, or can you just reach so many people without having to actually do the drudgery of walking around housing estates?
I think the air war or the social media war, and during the local and Europeans, you know, I went in and I looked at Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael's kind of social media kind of advertising spend, and they had kind of broken it down kind of by candidate, actually. So I think Simon Harris had to record something like, you know, how many local constituency wards is there? 200 or something in the country. He had to name each and every single one of them. And if you watched them kind of back to back, as I did, you could see him slowly losing the will to live.
Well, that was a lot to do. 200
you know,
local.
Doing it to camera. But I mean, yeah, knocking on doors in a small country like Ireland where it can be done. Because we're not the same as America, where you need to have that big kind of massive air war and traditional TV and online kind of battle. In Ireland, where you can knock on doors, people do want it, people do like it. And also, like,
they say,
a politician of any substance loves knocking on doors. They like talking to people and they are willing to take the flak because it's a drug for them.
I think it's relevant too, like, if when you get as we did for the last elections, you know, 40 people on a sheet, you know, and if you're not sure, if you're swinging either way, the person that made the effort to come to your door, or their sister or brother or mother or whoever, you say, well, they made the effort, I'll give them
the one you've
somewhere
met.
On the list.
Well, that's also the panic, you know, if you're not across all the potential candidates, you know the election, the voting is coming up just as a punter. And certainly what we realised, myself and wife, were like, oh my God, I haven't done any research. Who's good? You know, and
I'm not sure I ever believe people when they say, it usually means they're not voting for you when they say, well, I have all the leaflets, I'm going to study them. Yeah. And you sort of think, now some people probably do, maybe you do and your wife, but honestly, a lot of people sort of say, when they haven't quite made up their mind, this is a line that you get all the time. I'm going to study the literature, and I don't know how many people do.
I think personal references are very important. So, my wife was like, "Oh, well, my best friend said this person came to the door, and they're trying to do X, Y, Z for the locality." So that, then you go, "Oh, okay, that's a good bit of information."
But the main issue, really, about knocking on doors is it gives you this, and I love it. It gives you this unbelievable insight into the lives of people. It's so privileged. And people are so open with you. And you know then the social issues, the issues in the area. That's how you know, you know, what people are concerned about in your area.
Which aren't always necessarily
people,
reflected online
on
either.
Yeah, exactly.
It can be skewed online. I want to move on to the budget because that it appears in the Business Post today on page 8. And it's saying the push will soon come to shove in coalition tussle over pre-election budget. So this is looking at the possible treaties we're going to get the little sweeteners before a potential election. And the possible infighting around that as different parties want to give away different things. Brian, you know, what are you seeing? Who wants to give us what?
Fine Gael wants to give us tax cuts, shockingly. But I think what was most interesting in that piece in the Business Post by Colonel Thomas is the cost of increasing the income, the inheritance tax threshold from 335 grand to 400 grand is actually only 52 million euro. Now, only 52 million euro. But in the broader context of the tax and spend budget. So we have about 1.2 billion in terms of, I think, tax cuts to give away. Most of that is going to be in terms of indexing the income tax band so people pay less in their income tax in USC. There's going to be about 150 million, 200 million left over from that that the government will be able to, quote unquote, play with. I think for the cost of 50 million for voters in Dublin in particular, with house prices going up the way they are, and it hasn't been changed in 12 or 13 years since the crash, it seems like a bit of a gimme. 52 million is a small enough figure. Mm. And the only other thing I'd say that really struck me, I was talking to a friend of mine who's from, you know, I think it's fair to say a more working class area of Dublin, would not be, sorry, Francis, a natural Fine Gael voter. But basically the house is going to come to them at some point in the future. Yeah. And they turned around to me and they said, this is a working class issue for people who have, who got their first home or their family got their first home in the 80s or early 90s. And they would feel that they will have to sell their home to be able to pay for that tax. So it's not just the people in the salubrious surroundings of Dunleary and South Dublin who obviously want this. I was really struck by that friend of mine who comes from a working class community who was saying, I also want to see this. But also, does anyone ever want to pay more tax than they strictly have to, whether you're ostensibly left-wing or not?
Yeah, but of course the inheritance tax is an extra sticky one that feels like a double taxation for so many of us. I want to move on to US politics, and we will be covering this in a little bit more depth later on in the show after 11 o'clock. But there's certainly some interesting stories. The Sunday Independent on page 6 today, Eric Trump, Donald's son, spoke to Niamh Horan, which was a bit of a coup. And I think an interesting take as well, because it, you know, it, obviously he's, you know, partisan and biased because his dad is running for president on the Republican ticket. However, it also gave an insight into what it's like to have your dad shot at. And he was watching it on television. He had his kids on his lap. And suddenly, a man who's no stranger to using guns himself, he recognised the pop-pop as he heard them exactly as what they were, automatic rifle fire. And he had those moments of wondering if his dad, which is Donald Trump, love him or hate him, is still his dad, was still alive. I mean, it was an interesting piece, wasn't it, Anna-Marie?
Yeah, it was. And absolutely. I've been a bit cold about it, I suppose, insofar as I saw it almost instantly because I was at a party and came in and it was on. And, you know, at no time did I think he's dead. There was no or nearly dead. You know, it was very obvious. It was the ear straight away. And he didn't fall to the ground. He went down to the ground himself, you know. And fact was like that I read the article. And he was a bit dramatic. But then again, he's his son. And obviously, he'd been a different place. And his kids were there and all that. You know, it certainly has been a useful tool for Trump insofar as, you know, getting the sympathy vote now, because it did happen and there was a lot of speculation in the beginning. Was it an inside job? It couldn't have been an inside job. Who's that good that could be so close and not kill the man? So it was a horrendous thing to happen to anyone.
Desperate
and I think it's
security failure.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is a very interesting interview by Niamh Horan because it's so personal. Mm. And it does ring true. You know, he's watching it. He's at home with his children on his lap and he sees his dad in attempted assassination. And he's a competitive shooter himself. And he said, I knew you shouldn't miss at that level and that distance. So the security failure is extraordinary. But, you know, he says he's coming to Ireland this week and his dad will be here in the near future as well. And then he has a go, of course, at the vice president, the French candidate. He can't resist it in the end, you know.
Yeah, well, like, they're so entrenched. But I think what's interesting, and I think this is the shift that Kamala Harris has introduced into the narrative over the last week or so, is that, you know, again, love him or hate him, you know, how Donald Trump reacted literally under fire, you know, was very impressive. You know, the fact that how would any of us here, how would any of you listening react?
Oh, much better.
If a bullet had just taken the top of your ear.
I mean, the gut instinct to put the hand up and fight, it just tells you so much about it. Well, he's always been known, he is a street fighter, but even in the moment of an attempted assassination to be able to do it so quickly, extraordinary.
And if you think about the uncertain voters, the swing states, the people who are on the fence thinking, you know, not, you know, annoyed at Democrats for maybe downplaying Joe Biden's cognitive decline, feeling a little bit left out of the narrative. And suddenly they see how Donald Trump reacts and go, OK, maybe we do have a strong leader here,
well,
even if you don't agree with everything.
He?
However, that wave was cut short by Kamala Harris And
that's a big factor.
And, the energy that she has brought to the conversation, Brian. Yeah.
Well, I think two things. One, Trump's VP pick, J.D. Vance, just seems like an inherently weird guy and doesn't seem to actually have a huge amount of charisma and seems in the Sarah Palin kind of level of picks of vice presidential
picks. He kind of reminds me of someone that you brought to a dinner party who you didn't know very well. You know, to a table of good friends, and they have two glasses of wine in them and suddenly start talking complete rot.
Yeah.
And is he a wingman that you would want? Because he's saying some really offensive, outlandish and outdated things, I mean, and is making Trump look moderate.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. But I mean, I think a new attack line from Kamala Harris in the last kind of 72 hours is, what the Democrats have done and Joe Biden has kind of framed this election as was like about the threat of democracy and the future of the American Republic. And whether or not I or anyone else here believes that's true, I think Joe Soap here in Ireland and in America just goes, would you give me a break? Like, but actually what Kamala Harris has done in the last kind of couple of days has said, these guys are just weird. Like,
that's
listen
a great
to
line.
Him. Like, J.D. Vance said something in an interview with Megyn Kelly, a former Fox host there, something about like, oh, I know my wife isn't white, but I love her anyway. And you're like, what sort of absurd statement is that? Mm-hmm. You know, and if you can, if the Democrats who were palpably relieved that they had pushed Joe Biden out, I mean, the sense of relief when I saw Kamala Harris give her first speech at the HQ, like you could hear, albeit these people worked for Joe Biden and worked for the Democrats, the sense of relief was incredible to kind of just feel coming through the TV screen. So if they can kind of finesse that attack line around kind of, you know, these guys, not only are they a danger, we're not going to talk about that, they're actually just a bit odd. And you want these kind of weirdos in charge. And it's a much more, I think, effective attack line than going on about, you know, the importance of democracy.
And of course he was picked before, Kamala came on board.
Yeah.
So there's also that. Would it have been the same choice if it was slightly later,
he'd have to imagine who his vice president.
I think it would have been different. And I think the other point about Kamala is the way, you know, once you're given the leadership position, how suddenly perceptions change about you. And she has responded, and she was kept down as vice president, I think. It's probably a pretty tough position.
You know? Well, look, we're going to be looking more in depth at that with Paul Brandis, West Wing Reports founder and White House bureau chief, after 11 a.m. You can drop us a text if you want to add your comment to what we've been talking about or anything else that's on your mind today. Text 53106 at a cost of 30 cents or WhatsApp us on 087 1400 106. I've got my news panel here looking at the papers today. Brian Mahan, political correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail. We've got Francis Fitzgerald, former MEP, and Anna Marie McHugh, Assistant Managing Director of the National Ploughing Association. Francis, I'd love to go to you, and you may hate me for asking you this question because it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't scenario. But RTE is making a lot of the headlines and across all the newspapers today. What would you do if you were in there? Because there's a constant accusation of kicking the can, which now seems to be a phrase exclusively used for how the government treats RTE. But is it an impossible situation in terms of if you get rid of the licence fee, you're still essentially taxing people. We're still paying for it. So what would you do if you were there?
Well, I can understand why you wouldn't give up a revenue source from the public like the licence fee. I can understand why the Department of Public Expenditure would say, you know, this is a reasonably reliable, and if things get sorted more in RTE, then people will pay it and there's potential for increase. On the other hand, you're also giving taxpayers money when you give what is now a 3-year bailout to RTE, or funding, let's say. I'm sure RTE would want me to say funding. But like now you have a headline in the Sunday Times, fund all public sector like RTE demand unions, sort of health. They've had to live on, you know, 1-year budgets, the NGOs, the charity sector. So I think it's a close to an impossible decision. Now, Gary Murphy's a good piece. Courageous RTE will still be in limbo despite its 725 million windfall. I mean, how much does RTE need to run itself? I mean, it's a lot of money that they're getting as well as the licence fee. So I think Kevin Backus has a very big job to do to streamline. He's got 400 more redundancies to make. He's got changes. I mean, they have to keep up their public sector broadcasting remit, do more investigation programmes and so on.
But isn't that the funny thing? Yeah, you know, when you're listening to these stories, I sometimes think, what would it be like if this was a chocolate factory? You know, if it wasn't making television, we rarely we rarely talk about the chocolate. You know, the actual product is entertainment. It's information. It's what they're meant to be putting. But all we hear about is the machines that make the chocolate.
And the money.
And the, yeah, and the money, yeah. And
it has to move on. I mean, it has to get to the point, you're right, where we're actually talking about the work they do, what exactly is happening in the public sector broadcasting remit sign, which is really important, and just kind of move on. The general feeling seems to be that this isn't actually moving on, which in a way surprises me because, you know, it is guaranteeing funding for 3 years. It is continuing the license. Did people want all the money to come? I think the Greens did and they lost out at Cabinet. So I don't see it as the worst in the world to get 3 years funding.
Two things. One, I remember towards the back end of the height of the controversy, I was saying this when we were reading the paper before we came in, I went down to visit a friends of mine down in Waterford and they kind of just turned around to me. They went, Brian, for the love of God, will you please stop writing about RTE? Like, we are just sick of it. And that was like 6 or 7 months ago. So here we are still a year later. But the other thing I'd say is, Gav Riley has a piece in the Sindo about how this is a missed opportunity or whatever. I mean, that is just true. Like, the government, it very much looks like you catch Martin on one side, everyone else on the other side in a Mexican standoff for like 4 or 5 months. Everyone's saying they're going to make a decision at the end of July. And they eventually got what looks like a week, 10 days out and went, right, okay, Catherine's lost. Where do we find the money? And the Indo had a story yesterday about taking some money out of the social protection budget, which drove Heather Humphreys around the bend. So, I mean, but also this week, Micheál Martin kind of intimated or implied that to me at a doorstep that revenue basically said, we don't want to do it. And then he kind of walked that back a little bit. But then Peter Burke also said to me this week that, oh, well, we can't have revenue collect this taxation because it would dilute or weaken their powers and they're very efficient at doing what they already do. So it sounds like revenue told government to take a jump and government said fine. But actually, when you get down to thinking about how do you actually collect this tax if not through the license fee and you do want people to pay it directly, it becomes very difficult. Well, the government just fudged it in the end.
A texter makes an interesting suggestion. Would be a great election giveaway to scrap the TV license. The government have missed a trick. So even if it didn't affect people's pockets, the optics of it might actually get them a few votes.
The election is a key component of this decision-making process. The government did not want to have something that could be framed as a new tax by Sinn Féin in the run-up to a general election. Yeah. And they've just said, we'll keep the same thing.
I want to move on to a story that is making Mail on Sunday pages 18 and 19, the front of the paper as well. But also it's been one that's bubbling through for the last week or so. And it's involved Strictly Come Dancing. And Anna-Maria, I'll go to you for this one. In recent weeks, Strictly Come Dancing has become the subject of intense scrutiny after allegations about misconduct behind the scenes by a number of its professional dancers. And our own Laura Whitmore is in the papers today for saying that, yeah, she was on the receiving end of some inappropriate behaviour, as she calls it. It's an interesting one because on the outside, it's such a glitzy, glamorous show, but it seems to have this darker undercurrent.
Yeah, and this guy, Giovanni, is some piece of work by the looks of it. But Laura did say that she did mention it to BBC, but she didn't actually make an official complaint.
Yeah, so, and they are just allegations at this point, and we haven't really heard from these.
And we had a chat about it earlier on even, and you know, like, it's glitzy, glamorous, sexy. You know, and even with our own Dancing with the Stars, you know, it's all the movements and everything. And there's probably a place within it all that the broadcaster, BBC in this case, you know, have facilities in place that they're either have a good HR element to the event or just somebody there that's actually chatting to the dancers coming in. Because you might come in as a very ordinary person or, you know, you might be a star in a certain sector, but it's totally away from this area. And just how you're working with it and how it's going for you. And because it's very intimate, it's extremely intimate.
Yeah, involvement. Not to belittle in any way any allegations of bullying in any workplace, even if you are covered in sequins at the time. But isn't it a very intense thing to go into? And maybe we could liken it to going into work in, you know, a kitchen with angry chefs, you know, that it's an environment that you're not used to. These dancers are used to it.
Yeah.
As you say,
and
you're literally
so long
pressed
day.
Up against these Absolutely. People. You know,
hours on end.
It would be a miracle if there wasn't some friction.
Well, it is a sort of boot camp, right?
Yeah.
Which is what you're saying. You know, you go in there, you're not a dancer to begin with, you're with an expert. Incredible pressure, but it's a question of boundaries then.
Mm.
And clearly, I think Anne-Marie is right about the employer, the BBC or whoever it is, having a duty of care
as well, obviously, all the time in this very pressurized environment. Something has clearly gone wrong. And, personality, is it bullying? How, in some of these areas, trying to define exactly what happened is quite difficult. Two different sides to the story. But I think, nevertheless, we know bullying cultures can prevail. Mm. We've seen it. We've seen people kill themselves after, Love Island. You've seen those sort of, by the way, they make, you were saying, Emery, they make so much money. You know, it's so glitzy. Yeah.
And in fairness, Laura would be fairly strong personality. You know, it would take a lot for her to be affected by it. And she was. So,
it's obviously something not right here that they do need to look at.
I think the difficulty,
notwithstanding the culture, the
what they're up against as well is the perception that they receive the fruits of this show. I mean, it literally, particularly in the UK, will make your career. You will be able to charge more for every gig you do after appearing on that show. Yeah. So for celebs to be complaining that, it was a bit rough on the dance floor, people can have little sympathy, and I guess that can stand in the way of these allegations being taken seriously.
Yeah, and yet if you have a number of people, I think Laura said there were others as well. It's a bit like the, not comparing it exactly, but you go back, if there's cumulative, complaints, and people being concerned, there is something going on. And BBC have to put it together and say, how do we make this better for people, despite the points you're making?
Mm. Have any of you been watching the Olympics before I let you go for the day?
Yeah, I was just going to say, yesterday I ended up watching, I think, like the badminton and the rugby sevens.
I watched the badminton last night. Yeah. The young fella from Dublin, he was absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. What's the fast? How fast does the fastest shuttlecock go? What's the world record?
I don't know.
Over 500 kilometres an hour.
Oh, my God.
I was looking at their reflexes. I've never seen anything like it. I'm a Formula One fan, and I love watching the F1 drivers training and the little things they do before races to kind of speed up, to dial in their reflexes. I would say these badminton players could teach them a thing or two.
What about Anton DuPont with standing away from the Six Nations to get his Olympic medal, and he got it?
Yeah.
And he's won the 70-metre run last night.
Let's not forget Rhys, who's into the final.
Yeah, yeah. Look, it's wonderfully exciting. I hope you stay tuned to the Olympics. More Irish hopes today. That's all we have time for with our panel. Brian Mahan, political correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail. Thank you to you. Francis Fitzgerald, former MEP. Thank you. And Anna-Marie McHugh, Assistant Managing Director of the National Ploughing Association. Best of luck with the ploughing this year. Thank you to all of you.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.